everybody feeling after a night in Vegas? We were going to have a game. We're going to do a little bit of rate making for a new product. I thought it fit well with the rate making and product management seminar for hangover insurance. But you guys are all here, so maybe we don't need it after all. We'll just see who lies down over in the corner later on during this. My name is Tom Hettinger. I am the chairman of the RPM seminar committee. As you can tell, I don't have much of a voice, and that's not because I was out late drinking. I actually was losing it earlier on. I wish I could tell you why it is. For some of you, you're probably going, good, he won't talk much then. You still get to hear my words on a few thoughts today. We're very fortunate. We have a lot of things going on. We're very happy. We have such a great turnout for this this seminar. It's a brand new seminar. We try to combine some of the best seminars in the past to come up with the best of breed. And this is a learning process for us too. So I encourage you as you go through the next couple days to write down your thoughts, fill out your evaluation forms. Actually, it's going to be online evaluation forms. And I'll talk a little bit about another opportunity we have to share your ideas with us too. But you know, one of the things, maybe we should step back for a second here. During one of the worst economies ever, we have a number of people showing up to a seminar to try to learn. And I'd say, you know, don't just use this as a continuing education opportunity. I would like to challenge you to use this as an opportunity to find ways to gain advantages for your company, because it's more important than ever for you to walk away from here with something that you know you can implement and use as a way to stay on top in this tough environment. And remember, you're going to hear a lot of different things. You'll hear some great ideas from people. A successful implementation does not have to be the biggest, baddest thing right away. It can be a baby step, starting, getting things going just enough so that you're ready to go the next time. So use this opportunity. Challenge yourself, challenge our speakers, challenge them a lot, especially if they were out last night at JET. Don't be afraid to ask those questions, because what ends up happening is that presentation is only one small piece of it. I bet you'll learn more during the question and answers than you ever thought you would, and you may actually end up finding it to be more useful to you. I would like to take an opportunity to thank our exhibitors. Hopefully you've had a chance to walk around and see them over in the back room there. They'll be there throughout the whole seminar. We have a number of them. We have Carfax, the Banking and Insurance Group, which is presenting a demo during the break at 2 o'clock today. We have DRC, which is presenting a demo during the break at 9:30 tomorrow. Eagle Eye Analytics, EMB, who's also the Patfolio sponsor, and maybe I know a little bit about those guys too. First American Proxy Solutions, InsureQuote, a LexisNexis company, ISO, Marshall Swift Beck, Pinnacle Actuarial Resources, who's also the Lanyard sponsor, Prior Associates, Executive Search, who's also the Penn sponsor, and actually they are the hangover cure this morning with a bottle of water for you coming in, and then Valen Technologies also. So please visit our sponsors. If you get a chance, listen to what they have to say. I think you'll find things that do dovetail into what we're doing today. Before I get on to our keynote speaker, I would like to make a few announcements about the content. This is one of the fun things about being chair. I get the last minute emails, so as I sat outside waiting to come in here, I did get one from one of our speakers who said he is awfully sorry, woke up with a horrible fever, and looks like he has gallstones. And I said, I was about ready to reply back, do that on your time, not on mine, but I had a bit of a heart. So tomorrow's session in Barbados Room A, the product management is as any insurance product, a commodity, is going to be canceled. I apologize on that. We also had a cancellation for tomorrow in the last session, the CL4, Pricing Approaches and Considerations for Large Accounts. That's going to cancel. We're going to replace that, though, with a little bit different session. Chat with the chair. You'll get to take that opportunity to come in, tell me what you think about this seminar, what you'd like to see out of it, what you thought was good, hopefully, out of this seminar. Doesn't have to be all bad. And you'll get to hear a little bit what I think about where this seminar is going to. So it is important. This is our first year with this. We'd like to see this grow, and we recognize that we're always going to be changing and making things better, okay? With that said, I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker today. We're very fortunate, as we went through, the committee was going through this. Actually, I'm sorry, I did forget one very important thing. I would like to recognize my committee, who did a wonderful job of coming up with these different sessions and working very hard throughout the year. If the committee members could stand up, please. Plus, they had to put up with me the whole time. So, with that said, I would like to introduce our speaker. As I said, we're very fortunate. Sometimes, you know, looking through who will get for a keynote speaker, does somebody understand what an actuary is? You know, that's that phone call normally, okay, we're actuaries, and I go, well, what is that? Didn't have to worry too much this time. We found a speaker that is speaking our language, I believe. Ian Ayers is one of the leading authorities on what he calls super crunching. Yeah, he's the author of Super Crunchers. Hopefully, most of you have got the book. He'll also be signing it later on in the back there as you go out through that back door. So please stop by to see him. He's written several other books and many articles. He is the William K. Townsend Professor at Yale Law School and a professor at Yale School of Management, a lawyer and an economist. Mm-hmm. He is a columnist for Forbes magazine. He's done been a regular commentator on public radio, Daily Business Show, Marketplace, and he regularly writes op-eds for the New York Times. Maybe more importantly, he's been on Oprah. Okay. Primetime Live and Good Morning America. Maybe the most important thing here is he's not just an academic sitting here spouting ideas. Ian puts this into practice. He's asked to do analyses on a daily basis from many different organizations. Things that can be as interesting as taxicab tipping, discrimination in car sales, I dare say reckless sex in Vegas. He even put it to play with his own children to say they wanted a dog, if you can believe it. He challenged them to a little statistical analysis for them to earn that dog. So it's one of these things is sometimes, you know, it's good to hear far-fetched ideas and see if we can take something from it. Ian puts into practice. I think that's very important for what we're going to hear today. So if we would, please welcome Ian Ayers.
Good morning. I can't tell you how happy I am to be able to speak in front of a bunch of other number crunchers. I thought I'd start with a story of predictive analytics going to the movies. I don't know how many of you had a chance to see The Interpreter. It was a Nicole Kidman vehicle a couple years ago. Modestly successful. But I want to tell you about something that happened before a single frame of this movie was shot. A company called Epagogix had the audacity to predict that it would sell 69 million domestically. And it was a pretty accurate prediction. It turned out that it was part of a larger experiment where a studio gave them the scripts for 9 movies, and they asked Epagogix to make their predictions on the box office, and independently the studio made their predictions. They put both into a drawer and then waited, and Epagogix wasn't perfect. They only made accurate predictions on about two-thirds on 6 of the 9 scripts, but that was twice the accuracy of the studio, which traditionally only gets it right about a third of the time. But Epagogix went further on The Interpreter. They had the double audacity to predict how alternative scripts would have sold. If you had added in a young sidekick, they said it would have sold $12 million more. If they had emphasized the New York City and the UN location, $5 million more. An interesting thing, though, it was a very non-linear approach that they took, and they predicted that if you did both these things, it would have sold $20 million more. Studio didn't go after it, so we don't know if that works well. But I'm telling the Epagogix story for two reasons. One, if Epagogix can be successful number crunching on a very high degree of difficulty question with relatively little data, it shouldn't be surprising that people in this room can do a much better job on trying to score out some insurance risk where we have much larger data sets. The other reason I tell it is that Epagogix doesn't use traditional regression analysis. One reason they came to nonlinear results is they use a neural network approach that where they code 200 variables about scripts, and by the way, about the promotion budget and the director and the actors. Surprising thing is that the actor's identity has very little to do with the predictions on this. They train a neural network on historical data, and then they make predictions out of sample. One of the things that as something to take away from the seminar, I'm not exactly sure yet what the appropriate role of neural networks are for actuaries. But and to be very honest with you, there are these separate constraints of whether you're going to be able to sell the results of neural network analysis to regulators who want to know what the underlying coefficients mean. And these are very opaque since it's so massively nodal. But I would say to you, one theme of this talk today is that you guys should be thinking about trying alternative approaches. Even if your central approach is general linear regression, I would every once in a while try a neural network and just see is the y hats going off in a different direction for some parts of your population, and start using it. Is it robust? Is your traditional approach robust to alternative specifications? This idea, in some ways, for this group, I dare call it the new wisdom of crowds, but it's very chic in certain number crunching areas to say, well, you really want to be able to make a prediction about how many jelly beans are in this jar. I ask you all to come up with your individual predictions, and the average is a pretty accurate prediction of the jelly beans. But there are all kinds of things where the wisdom of the crowds of asking people what they think doesn't work. It wouldn't work if I asked you 3 weeks ago to predict what the Watchmen movie was going to gross. And actually, it wouldn't do a very good job if I asked lots of individuals to predict what the chance of loss, of fire loss, was for a particular commercial establishment. Instead, the new wisdom is actually incredibly old for actuaries. It's going back and finding the wisdom that is locked in historical data. There are some problems with this this regression approach, this mining of historical data. One that comes up immediately with, as an application to insurance, is the possibility of statistical redlining. So it is possible that if you control for enough variables, you might come very close to replicating the results of racialized insurance schemes, sad part of some of our past. And one positive way of that I at least think about it is I, with regard to this possibility of statistical redlining, is to make a big distinction between the cost side and the revenue side. To the extent that you take an actuarial approach that focuses on probable loss, that I think is much, much more defensible as a approach to justifying before a regulator different pricing schemes. But to the extent that you are taking a statistical approach based on profitability that is having disproportionate effects on minority groups, not based on cost, but on your ability to pull revenue out of customers, that is very different approach. And so on some of these questions about making statistical inferences, this question of statistical redlining, whether you focus on the cost or the revenue side seems to me to be important. This is a not an insurance example, but another place where number crunching is coming in and impacting our lives and the lives of consumers without them knowing about it. This is Pandora.com. They've gone out and they've run, first of all, they've coded tons of attributes of songs, and they've done an analysis, a regression analysis, trying to figure out what kinds of songs are like each other. And it's very effective. I put in that I like Bruce Springsteen, and they come back with a song by the let me tell you, my daughter puts in groups or singers that I don't like, and she gets back different sets of songs that work for her. So this shouldn't be a surprise, even though number crunching of this type has been done for decades, going back to at least 1914 when this society was started. It's having an impact on many other aspects of our lives. I call it the rise of data-driven decision-making. And one of the reasons it's happening is kind of symbolized by this button. It's the on-off button, the toggle switch on many electronic appliances. But it has this kind of hidden meaning. At least it was hidden to me for a while. That is actually a 1-0. And so it is the fact that we are now able to think of information in ones and zeros, in binary, that has allowed us to capture and store massive amounts of information that we just didn't have even 15 years ago. And what's really new about supercrunching isn't really the techniques. They've been around for close to centuries, more than 100 years. But what's really new about what I'm calling supercrunching is, first, the size of the data sets, and secondly, the speed and the scale of their impact on decision making. I'm going to try to talk a bit about that today. Here's a very simple example that I really don't need to talk to you much about. This is actually regression output from a guy named Orly Ashenfelter. He's one of the world's great econometricians. But he also has this passion for wines. And this is a regression output for a very simple regression, trying to predict the quality of Bordeaux wines. And by the way, you can tell here that higher growing temperatures, because this positive coefficient, it tends to increase the quality of Bordeaux's. This is just like a crowd that I don't have to go to spend a lot of time. It shouldn't surprise you that global warming has been good for Bordeaux's because of that positive coefficient. Last 10 years has been bumper quality for Bordeaux wines. But I mention Orly to you because there's this, what I'm going to call on the next slide, an iron law of resistance, that traditional experts don't react well when number crunchers come in and invade their field. Matter of fact, I can tell you guys a joke that I can't tell most audiences here. I think the Wine Spectator had this review of Orly Ashenfelter's regressions, and they said, you know, this stuff is garbage. He very rarely is able to exactly predict the wine price, and half the time his prediction is too high, and half the time it's too low. Right, so this is the idea, having an unbiased estimator, you know, is a bad thing. So there you go. I just am in nirvana here that my audience understands that joke. You guys know that it's hard when the people aren't number crunchers. They're going to tend to resist. But I want to even push you that it's, in other aspects of your life, it's hard to think that what you do can be improved by number crunching. The fact that as a teacher, could I do a better job teaching? Could we make better admissions with number crunching? And I personally, even as somebody that crunches numbers all the time, I have to work through this. It's not just the other guy. These ideas of predictions that I've already mentioned to you, Orly makes wine prediction, Epigogix makes movie predictions, Pandora makes music predictions. I put eHarmony in this group. eHarmony, it's a dating service, but it's a very different kind of dating service. In traditional dating services, they would ask you, you know, who do you want to go out with? And they would try to match you to those persons. eHarmony instead gives you a personality test. And they've then done regressions on thousands of couples, and they try then to predict what kind of personalities would be most compatible with others. And it's a very different service because they'll end up matching you with people you wouldn't have ever thought you would have done well with based on regressions. And by the way, it's also similar. eHarmony, like Orly and like Epigogix, they're making predictions about very immature products. Epagogix makes predictions about movies before they've been made. Orly makes predictions about wine before anyone has tasted them. And eHarmony makes predictions about couples that have never met each other. But this same kind of regression approach, it's being used in scores of other circumstances. It's behind attrition predictions at 3M and Corporate Express. The Canadian Revenue Agency is using taxpayer scoring, and it's behind claims scoring at bunches of insurance companies, including Infinity Property and Casualty. And I want to, though, talk a little bit longer about some number crunching that I actually did with Steve Levitt, the famous co-author. By the way, I predict he's going to win a Nobel Prize in the next 20 years. Steve and I did some number crunching on LoJack that is quite central to insurance issues. Our big idea here, the theory we wanted to test, is about hidden precaution, the big difference between LoJack and many traditional car alarms is that LoJack is hidden to a potential thief at the time when the thief has to decide whether to steal or not, whereas traditional car alarms often have a red light that beeps when it's on, and or the club is definitely very visible to potential thieves. And our thought here is that hidden precautions could have a externality, a positive externality. It could reduce theft generally in a city because the thieves would get scared. They wouldn't know whether this car or another car had it, and they might just generally get scared of doing this. One early hint that we had that we were onto something is just looking at chop shops. If you want to see about this positive externality, in Los Angeles, LoJack has been responsible for closing down, I think now close to 200 chop shops. And you start seeing the external benefits. The cops track the stolen car to the chop shop, and they not only get the LoJack car back, but they get four or five other cars back, and they close down the chop shop for a while. And others pop up, but that gives you an idea about this external benefit. So what Steve and I did is my biggest contribution to this is I got LoJack to give me their data. A junior executive almost got fired for giving it to me. But we looked at data from 1981 to 1994 in 60 large cities, and this graph will tell you a lot of our crucial finding. You can see two lines here. The darkened line are LoJack cities that are, and this is what was happening to crime before and after LoJack came in. And you can see that generally crime was going up beforehand. And that's, by the way, the spike in crime is one of the reasons these cities were motivated to install LoJack in their police cruisers. But after LoJack comes in, there is a substantial downturn in crime. And the other line is saying is we've tried to match, holding time constant, similar non-LoJack cities that were also experiencing increases in crime. But you'll notice after LoJack came in, they didn't see the downturn. To see this in a specific city is Boston is one of the has the biggest penetration of LoJack. About 10% of cars have LoJack in them in Boston. And you can see what the lower line is what was happening nationally in non-LoJack cities, a general upturn in crime. And in Boston, after LoJack comes in, we see a substantial downfall. We did a lot of fancy regressions on this. The bottom line is that we found that the social benefit from LoJack was 15 times greater than the cost of putting these in, but that most of the benefit was external to the owner of the LoJack. Most of the benefit isn't that it reduces your chance of getting a theft loss. It a little bit comes back to you because you have a much bigger chance. Instead of a 60% chance of getting your car back, you have a 95% chance of getting your car back. That's some return. And secondly, people in this room have been somewhat generous, and you give discounts if you use LoJack. But the issue here is you guys aren't being generous enough. that when somebody puts in LoJack in their car, they're reducing the loss on auto theft for other people in that city who don't have LoJack. Right? And that's and if you wanted to make your company do better, this is kind of a problem though. You're also reducing the losses of your competitors, right? And so that's kind of a limitation on this. But something that Steve and I didn't get to, and I think this is a study that's really well, I'd love to work with somebody in this room on. I think there's another benefit of LoJack, and it's that that LoJack helps reduce insurance fraud. And here's the deal. LoJack is randomly put, its location is even secret to the owner of the car. And when you put LoJack in your car, it's a commitment device not to commit insurance fraud. Because if you give it to your cousin Vinny and then put in an insurance claim, the cops track the car to your cousin Vinny, right? And this is not a hypothetical because matter of fact, I was driving with, I was doing a taped episode for a TV show, and I was driving with Connecticut police doing a LoJack bit, and we got a hit on LoJack, and we tracked it to a neighbor, to a cousin, and this happens a lot. It doesn't happen on original owners, but there are a lot of people who put LoJack in their car, and then they sell the car used, and they forget to tell the owner that it has LoJack in it. And so then the new owner commits insurance fraud. And when Steve Levitt and I first did our analysis, we said, look, LoJack can reduce the crime rate generally, but that it shouldn't reduce the chance that your car is going to get stolen, because the thieves don't even know whether it's on your car. The city's average crime rate should go down, but your car theft rate shouldn't go down. I now have a different hypothesis. I think that there could be an easy study where you actually look at the reduction of auto theft of LoJack cars versus non-LoJack cars, and that will actually give you an estimate of how much insurance fraud there is in auto theft. And we don't actually have it, because that differential, that lower is the result that non-LoJack cars have insurance fraud and LoJack cars don't. Okay, and by the way, we don't have good estimates of how much insurance fraud there's out here, so here's an indirect way of doing that. One of the most powerful things about all of these regression approaches, which includes all these scoring approaches, is that the very estimate that makes the prediction, that gives you your Y hat, also can tell you the precision of the estimates, not just the precision of the coefficients, but you can figure out the precision of the Y hats. I love Faircast, which has taken terabytes worth of historical airline fare data, and it'll make predictions about whether the future price of a flight you want to take is going to go up or down. So if you're going to fly from JFK to Las Vegas, as I just did in a couple of months, you can plug that flight into Faircast, and that arrow in the middle will tell you whether they think the flight's going to, and they're predicting that the price of the fare is going to go down, so they recommend that you wait. But what I love is that they tell you the precision of their estimate. They say that they're right on this kind of prediction 80% of the time. There might be other flights, JFK to Kansas City, that they're only right on 60% of the time. And something that I think could be another dimension where you guys might start doing more stuff here is paying more attention to the precision of your scores. Let's say you've done some claim scoring, and you have two people. You and I both have the same claim score for, let's say, fire, right? But it might be, just like on this difference between Las Vegas and Kansas City, the regression might say that you have a much tighter score prediction than mine. And if we're both on the edge of insurability,
they might be more worried about not buying because I'm not, they just don't have as much data on a person like me. So taking into account a next, so to be very clear, you know, I suggest that you go beyond scoring to start thinking about the precision of the scores so that not all equal scores are equally precise. By the way, Faircast will stand behind its prediction by selling you insurance on this question. There's a new site out called DelayCast that makes some pretty cool predictions about whether your flight will be delayed. Now, you know, can super crunching go wrong? Yeah, you bet it can. And I thought I'd try, this is an experiment that I've never done in a setting like this. I would like you all to help me on a handshaking experiment. So first of all, you have to do something. I'd like you to turn to somebody near you and shake their hand in a second. And I'll tell you when you can start shaking your hand. The game here, pretend that whether you know them or not, pretend like you're meeting them for the first time. Start shaking their hand. And I'm going to tell you to freeze. And I want you to freeze then, and then I'm going to ask you to look at your, then I'm going to ask you a question, okay? So you now, if you're not sitting next to somebody, you have to make eye contact and somehow decide whether you will shake hands, all right? So wait till I say, not yet, okay? No, wait until I say yes. All right, on your mark, get set, shake hands. All right, now freeze. All right, now this is the deal. I was on a keynote with a guy, an expert in body language, and he says the person whose hand is tilted on top wants to take control of the relationship. Now, but I want to suggest, that's one hypothesis. I want to suggest a different hypothesis that comes to me as more of a physical engineering hypothesis. That makes sense if we were standing up as we were. The body language makes sense, but you guys are all sitting down in a line, and I instead predict that people who are sitting to the right and have to reach like this are more likely to have their hand on top, and people who are like this are more likely. So now, here you can do some empiricism. If you are sitting to the right and your hand is on top, raise your hand. And if you were sitting, now put those down, if you're sitting to the left and your hand is on top, raise your hand. Okay? So this guy that was a great expert in body language, I think his hypothesis, he could go wrong with his number crunching if you don't take into account and by the way, that's the first time I've ever done that. So that's, by the way, did anybody shake hands with their left hand? Raise your hand if you shook hands with the left hand. Nope, because it would be cool if people were on their left hand, then I'd say that their left hand side people would be on top. Okay, I'm left hand. But anyway, number crunching can go wrong if you exclude other relevant hypotheses. I want, going back to AIG, I want to, this is even a scarier experiment, I want to share with you, my next book is going to be about risk management. It's a number crunching book about risk management, not for insurance company, but for personal investment for retirement. And I'm in this day where number crunching has made lots of people's investments, lots of companies' investments go belly up, I still want to say there's an important role for number crunching. And this story of mine is that I have a simple theory that we could do a better job in investing for retirement in diversifying time. And this is very simple theory, but it's going to go to a bizarre place soon. Everybody would know that it would be silly if you only invested in the stock market 1 year of your life, because you'd have all your eggs in that 1 year, and if it's a bad year, you're screwed, right? It's better to spread it out. And that simple idea, this is a pretty simple theory, should say you'd be better to expose yourself to the stock market with something close to equal dollar amounts every year of your life. that would be better diversification, just like you do better. It's really the same story as with asset diversification. You don't want to put all your eggs in one asset. You want to spread them out over different assets. We do a very bad job on temporal diversification because most people in this room only put a few thousand dollars in the stock market in their 20s, but many of you will have hundreds of thousands in the stock market in your late 50s and 60s. And from a temporal diversification, having $1,000 in the stock market in your 20s doesn't help you diversify having $1 million in the stock market when you're 60. It's as if your 20s don't really exist as far as temporal diversification. Now, that's the problem. How do we get over it? Well, I think that it's this aphorism that you shouldn't count your chickens before you're hatched is right, but instead, I think you guys should discount your chickens before you're hatched. That the problem here is that people, when I was in my late 20s, I'd started to get enough information to suggest that I was going to have a job, I was going to be able to save some money in my future, but I still didn't expose enough to the stock market in my 20s. And the way out of this is radical. It's to do what we do with housing and what we do with human capital. It's to invest stuff that we don't have. To actually, I'm going to suggest to you that borrowing money, investing in stock with borrowed money, investing on leverage, on a leveraged way, buying stock on margin when you're young, can end up reducing risk. So here's a bizarre strategy, buying stock on margin when you're young, but importantly, holding less stock when you're old. Because I want to go back to my simple idea. You want to, as a first cut, you want to put the same amount of dollars in the stock market every year of your life. How does that do? Well, people in the back here, this is going to, if your eyes are like mine, I'm going to have to explain this chart for you. But what I did here is I crunched numbers on this crazy idea, going back from stock data from 1871 through 2008. All right, this chart only goes through 2007. Trust me, even with the horrible last year, the results still hold up. And I think this would be surprising. I compared two different strategies for retirement. By the way, I took this historic data. I broke people into different worker cohorts, different investors. And I said, I imagine that each one of them earned a reasonable amount of money over a life cycle. I kept their investments constant across different cohorts. I had everybody live from age 21 to age 65. And I wanted to see if they were saving the same amount and just living in different periods. I had about 100 different cohorts here. What would have been the results over this long time period if they did different investment strategies? Well, the first thing in this column that has this circle there, a very simple strategy where they just invest 80% of their savings in stock and 20% in bonds. A constant 80%. They started 80%, they ended 80%. Whatever they have saved, 80% in stock, 20% in bonds. That's one traditional strategy. And down below, in small stuff, you can see what the mean and standard deviation is for these different 100 different cohorts that could have lived. And so one of the cohorts, 21-year-olds, started saving in 1871, and retired 45 years later. And then we had somebody that started living in 1872. I'm holding everything constant except for the strategy. But here, I try something different. This is the core of this idea. It's a new kind of life cycle fund. Traditional life cycle funds start you at 90% in stock and ramp down to 50% in stock. This is one that starts off investing 200% of your money in stock when you're young, and it ramps down here to 57% in stock when you're old, right? How could you invest 200% of your money in stock when you're young? You borrow money to do it, okay? And the life cycle does this for you. The thing that I want to emphasize is look at the mean and the standard deviation. No, I don't think many of you would have predicted this. the Bizarro Life Cycle Fund that is ludicrously risky to put 200% in stock when you're young. It has about the same mean, and its standard deviation is 20% lower. Why is that? It's because it is diversifying time better. It exposes people more to stock when you're young, less when you're old. On average, you have the same exposure to stock. That's why the mean's about the same. But being better diversified reduces your risk by 20%. And by the way, we've done this with other investment strategies. This is the traditional life cycle fund. And it turns out that you can do substantially better if you once you have a new tool for diversification, you could actually start trading, taking a little bit more aggressive position. But the big thing I want to, and by the way, this is what these are the individual results for my 100 different cohorts. The big thing that you still have to ask, and this especially in this environment. Okay, so it worked on historical U.S. data, even through 2008. But is this a robust result? Can we trust that? Are you willing to invest your retirement money on this crazy idea? And it's a very reasonable question to ask. One of the things you want to do is run the analysis as many different ways as you can. So we run it on the Nikkei data, and we run it on FTSE data, and we run it on a kabillion different Monte Carlo simulations, because maybe the future stock premium isn't going to be what it's been in the past, or maybe it has fatter tails than we think. And at any rate, the goal of this book, which is at heart a number-crunching book, is to try to convince people that this crazy theory actually is a better way to manage risk going forward. I want to now change gears and move from my first tool, which was basically regression analysis, to the second and last central tool of this. And one way to talk about the whole super crunching book is that there are these two central tools that world-class organizations should use, regressions and randomization. And if you're not using both these tools, you're presumptively screwing up. And as actuaries, you're deep into the crunching of historical data, but your organizations, I claim to you, have not been doing randomized testing enough. And some of you will reflexively say, oh, we can't because of the regulators. That's partially true, but I want to open your mind. You're still not doing enough, even taking into account the regulator constraint. So let me try to convince you of that. First of all, here's a little game, and I need a contestant to play with me. A volunteer? A volunteer in a green shirt? Are you going to play this? Okay, this is a very simple game, and I'll report it's a very simple game. These are actually two elements that appeared on monster.com for employers who are interested potentially in using monster.com. Monster.com wants to sign the employers up and get money from them, revenue. And so the simple question is, which of the elements, the upper element or the lower element, do you think is more effective at getting employers to use monster.com? Upper or lower? Can't take a lot of time. The lower. And why lower? The lower. Sticks out more. And I would add to that, I like the curved iconography, all right, and the arrow. Sticks out more. But it turns out monster.com did a randomized test on the internet where hundreds of thousands of people saw the upper element, and at random, another hundreds of thousands of people saw the lower element. And you and I didn't do well. Okay? The upper one, when the employer saw the upper one, they spent 8.3% more per visit. Right? And what I want to, there's a moment right here, I don't know exactly why, but I still trust it. Okay? As though I have great faith that they did the randomization right. And randomization is the great, they call these things in medicine randomized control trials, because randomization controls for everything else. When you have a couple hundred thousand people at random who are assigned to the upper element, and another couple hundred thousand people were assigned to the lower element. Randomization means that they are going to be statistically identical on every other dimension. They'll have the same proportion of people who are left-handed. They won't have this exact same height, but they'll have the exact same height distribution on both the top and the bottom by the law of large numbers. Another thing that you guys know about that I normally can't even mention in my talks. And so there is something really important here, because when I also talk about neural networks and regressions, but when you're doing that stuff, at some point, it's trust me statistics. And did you really control for enough stuff? And people are, you didn't have data on. There's always some data that you wish you had that you didn't have. When you do, this is not trust me statistics. When and you don't even have to have a theory to know, to have some trust that at least during this time period that something about that upper element is converting. Here's another example, and let's see if I can get somebody on this side that's willing to play with me. Great, all right, so this is eHarmony. They not only run regressions, I'm a fan of eHarmony on many dimensions because they do both of my central tools. They do regressions to find out who's compatible. They do tons of randomized tests on the internet where it's really cheap to do. So they wanted to test, this is their basic page. Their model is they want to get people to their page and register before you can do anything else. Nothing else to do on that page, register if you want before you can see content. They wanted to test the hypothesis. If they just provided first-time visitors with just a couple of links where they could get some information about what eHarmony is, would that increase the registration rate? And their whole model is get people registered, and then they can spam you to death and get you, convert you over, right? So you, sir, speak up a little bit. Do you think what converts people better, it's in behind you, more information or less? No, it's you, right there.
I would think less.
Less. Great, and you're doing, and where are you from, by the way?
San Diego.
San Diego. So you're doing very well. I ask where, because it turns out that in Canada, more information worked really better. All right? And there are a couple of reasons I tell this example. It's that after the fact, you can run a randomized test, and then you can actually run regressions on the results and look for sub-pockets. Even if on average it doesn't work well, you can look for sub-pockets where more information does work. And so it actually can complement regression approaches. How does this work with you all? So you guys, regulators can't let you do some things, but this idea of looking for sub-pockets, I think you guys should do some randomized tests about your rejects. On average, your rejects deserve to be rejected. But you know, if everybody rejects them, you're never going to get information about their losses. And I don't say that you should, this should be 50% of your rejects you should insure. You got a lot of rejects. Randomly accept 5% of your rejects. And by the way, it can be stratified. It doesn't have to be the clear rejects, but the people that were on the bubble. Go after some of them, and then look for sub-pockets, like Canada. Is there a Canada in your rejects that you're missing on? Okay? And one of the things that I think is a real, that's a real power, or something that you need to keep in the front of your mind, is there is a bandwidth to the human ability to implement stuff. And one of the things that's so powerful about the internet, you can not only do these randomized tests, but you need to attend to, either when you're doing regressions or randomization, how easily are you going to be able to go from doing the study to actually changing the decision? If it's going to take 6 months to get the analysis done and another 20 meetings before you can actually pull the trigger on making a decision, you're not going to do many studies. The faster that you can automate the implementation aspect, it's you're going to set yourself up for continual testing. And on the internet, with regard to randomized testing, this is happening. Google AdSense allows you to do, not only to do randomized testing, but it automatically starts shifting the ads to the winning, to the winner in the randomized test. So if you're a beer manufacturer and you want to say, should my Google ad says taste great or less filling, you can do a randomized test of which works best. And here's the great thing with regard to implementation, when if taste great starts having a bigger lift than less filling, Google will automatically shift from 50-50 to 60-40 to 70-30 in the randomization, and it will start moving this thing for you. So how are we doing on time? You're just picking these up. Okay, great. Another place that's coming in, there's so much internet insurance, an important question that comes up is whether online promotions, whether it stimulates or cannibalizes your offline sales, right? And this is another great place where randomization can help you. What should you do? Well, you can randomly turn on and turn off your online promotion at different cities. You know where the computer ISP addresses are. And this is what's really crucial. If you instead of manager says, no, I'm going to pick the cities, you've just screwed yourself because you don't have a well-controlled sample. You instead let randomization say what geographical areas will the promotion be on or off, and then you just sit back and you look at the offline sales. Did the promotion, and you compare it to what happened on the control. Did you get a lift relative to the control? It's a way of picking out whether your online insurance promotions are helping or hurting. By the way, this is just so easily done on the internet and cheaply done. Google Web Optimizer allows you to set up randomized experiments on your own web page. And I can't code in HTML, but in less than an hour, I was able to set up a randomized experiment. And by the way, I love the fact this is an example of the kind of output. They give you not just the prediction, but they give you the precision. It's the width of that green arrow that tells you that variation one is winning, and the precision with which their prediction is measured. And they give you the precision measure three or four different times. But I want to push you to think that this is not just something about online marketing. It is true, by the way, if every one of your companies is not doing randomized experiments on the web to market, you're making big mistakes. I mean, it's not a silver bullet, but you routinely get 5% lifts in whatever you care about, right? You're hear that. If you're not doing randomized experiments on the web, that's a big mistake. But I want to say it's not just about marketing and it's not just about the web. Sports strategies are a place where professional sports teams are screwing up right now. There's a huge amount of historical number crunching in every professional sport now since the Moneyball craze has come in. But up until just now, in humankind, there's never been a randomized test of sports strategy. And part of the game here, I won't call you out on this thing, but if you can't think of what a randomized, I'll give you an example or two, but if you can't think of a randomized test of sports strategy for your favorite sport, you're failing this lecture. All right? And what do I mean by this? Well, so I'm working with a professional baseball team right now, and we might do the following. This is a combination of regression and randomization. We're first going to do a regression analysis to make real-time predictions of what the opponent's next pitch is going to be. All right? Is it going to be a fastball or a curve? Is it going to be up and away? Right? And then the randomization kicks in. We're going to do a randomized experiment about whether sending the batter that a sign from the coach of what the next pitch is going to be, whether it helps or not. You have lots of at-bats, and do hitters who receive this sign, do they hit for a higher average than those that don't? Well, I'll give you one more, a very simple Duke basketball team, the Cameron Crazies, had about a dozen different distraction techniques when the opponent is shooting a free throw. Which one is most effective? Well, you randomly, and you don't need the coach here, you just randomly do the different distraction techniques and you pay attention to what the opponent's free throw percentage is. So these are, you know, when I have written about this, I got some bizarre comments. You know, some people say, oh, but professional sports is too important to do randomized testing on. And, you know, if that's true, well, we definitely should stop it in medicine because people's lives are at stake. But, you know, actually what we do in medicine, what do we start? We start with randomized trials with animals in medicine and lower stakes tests. And that could happen in sports, too. There are preseason games. There are minor leagues. There are college teams where you can start learning whether randomized stuff works. And I want to emphasize that it's not just, okay, so a lot of say, oh, I know there's randomized testing of price in England, and they don't have regulation. We can't do randomized test of price. But there's other stuff that you guys could be doing that is not constrained by regulators. I don't think you know whether apologies work or not. Okay? And could you do a randomized test of apology? Somebody puts in a claim, or you know, you're late on a claim, and yeah. And by the way, Continental Airlines did a randomized test on apology. People who had a transportation event, which is an event you don't want to have, they broke them in to three different groups. A third got nothing. A third got a form letter of apology. A third got a form letter of apology plus 2 months to the Admirals Club for free. All right? Turns out a form letter of apology dramatically increased retention. And the Admirals Club did even better. Even the Admirals Club became a profit center because after the 2 months, the people tended to sign up for the Admirals Club. All right? And I think it is an embarrassment that you guys have not done randomized tests on issues like apology. Or does a second letter increase retention? There are lots of things that are offline that aren't exactly on the initial marketing on the way in that could work. Let me give you another loop away from insurance. I'll come back to it. I have a deep passion about commitment bonds. Commitment bonds are different types, but one is you put some money down, and if you reach your goal, you get your money back. If not, it's forfeited to a charity, right? And my good friend and colleague, Dean Carlin, he did a randomized experiment of among a population of people who wanted to quit smoking and to see whether commitment bonds could help them quit. And those without the bonds had a 7% chance, great, of quitting, whereas those with the bond had a 33% chance. And this really is like the monster.com, well-controlled experiment, gives you a very powerful idea of this. I'm passionate about it because Dean and I co-founded an internet company that's just started, that's been in operation for a year. We've taken in over $1 million of commitment stakes. It's called stick.com, stick to your goals. I'm not just a co-founder, but like the Hair Club for Men, I use this. Last year I lost 10% of my body weight by putting $500 at risk every week without, and this is also, you know, empiricism starts at home. The red line is my weight. The blue line is my forfeiture, and I stayed below that, so I lost my weight without losing any money. I raise this as this is a little bit of a stretch, but it'd be interesting to see whether commitments could help on insurance condition. You all know that a lot of your insurance conditions are imperfectly followed. You have imperfect compliance when people tell you in auto that they drive less than 7,500 miles a year. And there are there are great technologies for you directly to do this, but I think there's a possibility here, consistent with the regulatory constraint, of saying we'll write you something if you use third party that does the refereeing and the enforcement for you. And all we want to know is have you signed up for a commitment contract with this third party? And if so, give you an example of this that's outside of insurance. Turns out that a lot of candidates spend $30 to $50 on get out the vote efforts. It's really expensive. The idea is you have to contact people five times in the last 24 hours before the last 48 hours before the election. It's incredible pain if you're already planning to vote. You guys, everybody in this room must have been contacted, especially if you're in a swing state. But if you made a commitment to vote, look, I promise I'll give $50 to charity if I don't vote. It'd be interesting to see if that could actually be a gift to your candidate, because they wouldn't have to spend that money on you. You guys could actuarially find out whether the commitment made them more likely to go and could help things. Let me go quickly through this. I want to emphasize these randomized experiments. They're all over the place. One of my favorite ones happened down in Mexico, where they wanted to see if contingent payments of money and food could help people get better educated, could help poor families be healthier and go to school more. And this progressive program gave up to $12 as a food transfer and up to $28 if for each child that attends school regularly. And to try to prove that it really works, they did a randomized experiment. They divided 500 villages at random into either progressive or non-progressive, and very dramatic response. School attendance was up. Health, serious illness was down. The big result, to me, humongous result, is that the kids in the progressive village in 2.5 years were 1 centimeter taller. And healthy kids grow faster. Centimeter in 2.5 years was a startling result. It's had a big impact in Mexico, where it's gone nationwide, a lot of money spent on this. And progressive-like programs have now spread to 30 other countries, including New York City, where Mayor Bloomberg's Opportunity New York is testing this thing. Randomized experiments start at home in another way. I did a Google ad experiment on the very title of my book. I started off loving The End of Intuition, but it turns out that Super Crunchers got a much higher result, and that's why I went for it. And one last, I think, experiment before I go out of here. There have been now hundreds of studies that test whether humans or actuaries can do a better job. One of my favorite ones is not that actuaries aren't humans, but it's whether humans, unaided by statistical analysis, can do a good job. This is of the Supreme Court, and this is the actual flow chart of a number crunched prediction over Justice O'Connor's voting. And it's incredibly crude. It doesn't take into account the issue involved in the case. And the big thing that I want to tell you is that this beat 83 Supreme Court experts. About a third of them were former Supreme Court clerks. And the big thing that I want to emphasize, I just want to speed through it to give some time for questions. Why is it that humans do badly relative to super crunching approaches? It's that humans, unaided by statistics, don't put the right weights on different causal variables. And the Supreme Court example, the experts know that the Supreme Court doesn't like California. The Supreme Court is, more specifically, they're likely to overturn opinions from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Every lawyer knows this, but the experts aren't willing to put enough weight on that important variable. Humans tend to fall in love with their special hypotheses, and they put too much weight on it. Well, actually, humans do a pretty good job when there's just one or two underlying drivers. If I have a can of Coke and I shake it up and I ask you to predict what's going to happen when I open it, everybody does a great job on that. But if there are 10 underlying drivers, there's a real mistake not to go with the regression. So what is the what's the takeaway here? It's not that this really is the end of intuition. It's still important for humans to come up with these ideas like who's sitting on the right or the left. But increasingly, the best decision makers will have to be willing to put their intuitions to the test. Thank you so much.